My name's Eddie. I'm an addict. So Natasha asked me to do the chair last week, and then she double booked, and she kind of said, "Can you do it the following week?" And I said, "No, I can't, because I've got loads of work commitments." And last night by 8 o'clock, she said, "You're still doing it tomorrow?" And I clean forgot about it. And I said, "Yeah, of course I'll do it, because kind of played through most of my work commitments, and only had half a day's work today." I'm very sensitive, so when you ask me something at 8 at night, my head goes into overdrive, and I did a million cheers before I fell asleep, you know, and they're great in my head, they're great in the bath, and when I sit here, do a cheer afterwards, I think, no, that wasn't great. But as I said to Rosie earlier, they're all personal, there is no good or bad cheers, they're all individual. So before I get on to the nitty-gritty, a little bit about myself. I was born in Sweden. I'm the eldest of three boys. My mum's Scottish. My dad's from the Seychelles. He's half Spanish, half French. Where I was born was a little village in the middle of nowhere. And we were made to feel unwelcome and outsiders. Mad Brits, they kind of called us. Yeah, we kind of were off key. Mum and dad split up, got sent to a children's home. I got dropped off. I went, "See you later, Mum." Months later, my mum and dad got back together. I said, "All right, Mum." I completely shut down as a kid. My two brothers cried their eyes out and had the normal reaction. I didn't. I just bottled it all up. From there, we moved to Spain. Still mad Brits. Still wanted to be accepted, but we're foreigners. After that, we moved to France. Still a foreigner. And then we moved to England. And we lived outside in a place called Runcorn near Liverpool up there. And I thought, yeah, I'll fit in here. I'm English, ain't I? No, my nickname was Sweetie because I was a foreigner. So I didn't fit in there either. So it didn't work out. So yeah, I've always wanted to be a local kid. It never happened. My first English accent was a scarce one. And it was quite broad. And then we went to India. They didn't understand a word I said. So I dropped a scarce accent and picked up an Indian one. So I used to have an Indian accent years ago. We came back to Spain, a white kid, Indian accent, that took the mickey out of me. So I dropped that accent and picked up the one I currently got. After Spain, we came back to England again, and parents were living abroad. So I ended up in a boarding school in Surrey with my two brothers. So English was kind of my fourth language. And I did a lot of moving around in a lot of schools as a kid, always wanting to fit in, always trying to fit in. So that's why this change of accents. If you listen to my brother, he sounds foreign. He never bothered changing his accent. I always picked up the local worst accent and tried to fit in. I wanted to be accepted. School, I wasn't interested in. I was very disruptive, into drugs, into drink, into everything. I wanted acceptance, and it was easier to do something negative and be heard rather than do something positive. If you did anything positive in my family, no one said anything. You did something negative, you got told off. So that was a reaction. I wanted to be heard, basically. So I did a lot of negative things in school. Headmaster 1 year said, "You come back next term, you're getting expelled. So I advise you not to come back." My dad was working in Libya. My mum was living with him. So my mum asked her sister, who lived in West London, "Can my son, me, come live with you?" And she said, "Yeah, of course he can." So that year, I never went back to school. My two brothers went back to school. So that was the first, except in children's home time. It's a long time since we were split up. And off I went to West London to live with my auntie. Unknown to my mum, her three eldest boys were heroin addicts. They refused to give me heroin. I wanted to be part of the gang because that was my default setting, the way I grew up. I always wanted to fit in. And they refused point blank to give me heroin. It was all right to have a spliff, to drop a few pills, but they weren't letting me inject drugs. And one night, one of their friends stayed overnight, my youngest cousin, and he woke me up in the morning and said, "Do you want a hit?" And I said, "Yeah, of course I do." And he took me down to West End. You know, as long as I bought him a hit, I got one. That was it. off to the West End, not far from the Trafalgar Square meeting, was my first hit in the toilets. And as Rosie said, it was a duck to water. I was shut down, and I was struggling to stay shut down. And with drugs, it made it easier. And I thought, this is great. Hooked up with a girl who was 16, I was 17, and I thought, yeah, I'll do this for a year, and then I'll get a job. That 1 year turned into 31 years of injecting on my life, and that was never, ever the plan. So started off with great intentions. I honestly thought I would show people I could use drugs successfully. I didn't think I'd get addicted. You know, I was a massive head. It's not going to affect me. I'm too strong-willed, all the usual rubbish. And it wasn't long before I had a habit and realised what they were talking about. In and out of prisons, spent about 5 years of my life in prison in the 80s. The three cousins I started using with, two overdosed and died in the 80s. One got dumped in the bins in Shepherd's Bush. You know, they just flung them there after the OD. So it was nothing glamorous about my using either. The 90s come. Yeah, by now the drug scene changed, and it was getting more violent, and I was getting into fights and things. And to avoid that, I went to a private doctor and got a massive injectable script, and I thought I'd cracked it. So the rest of the 90s I don't remember. A lot of daytime TV, picking up a huge script, and selling some to pay the doctor and some to pay the chemist, and the rest I used. 2003 came. I was homeless and everything, in a hostel down the West End, but as long as I had my drugs, I didn't care. Got diagnosed with Hep C. I didn't care about that either. Wore that as a badge of honour. You know, I was completely resigned to the fact I was going to use for the rest of my life now. 2003 comes, and I got a phone call from home, and it was my mum saying, I need to come home. So on the back of my head, you know, I'm still getting a hit ready, got no veins, going in my groin, you know, all the messy, you know, I was a proper street user. And so I thought, my dad's passed away, he's got cancer. So after a couple of hours, getting stoned and all that and going home, I knocked on the door, my dad answered, and I knew then that one of my brothers had died, and he said it was my youngest one. He just built a restaurant and a club in Croatia, and this was not long after the Yugoslavian war, and when the country all kind of split up into Croatia and the other countries and Serbia and whatnot. And he had army checkpoints back then, and he went through one, didn't show up at the second one, and they went looking for him and found he'd driven his car off a bridge and he died instantly. We wanted to blame someone. It was no one. It was his own fault. He was high in cocaine and alcohol, and that kind of really hurt me. From that day onwards, not instantly, but over the next 5 years, the drugs stopped working for me, and I was just miserable. And by the time I went to rehab, I was going to bed every night, didn't want to wake up in the morning. And, you know, I was waking up every morning and going through the same thing. It was painful. Then off to rehab, and I thought I'd get rid of my Class A problem. I was still going to take Valium, I was still going to have a spliff, and I was still going to drink. Yeah, but I ended up in a 12-step rehab, completely clueless. And they didn't argue with me when I put across my point of view and what I wanted. They must have seen it a million times. They just kind of left me to it. And through time, and you sit in these groups, you kind of listen, and it all makes sense. But back then, my detox was horrendous. I lied about the amount of drugs I was using to get in there. I told them I was using less, and, you know, I was rushed to A&E and everything. It was horrendous. And I thought the first 2 weeks I wanted to use constantly, but none of the local kids could organize a syringe and a bag of gear for me. That's all I wanted. And, you know, lucky for me, they couldn't. After 2 weeks, I said, I'm never doing this again. And I thought, I'm going to stay clean. And I was kind of like my step one, the foundation for the rest of my recovery. I thought, I'm never going back to it. They moved me on a week early because it was extremely disruptive. I was just too physically shot to engage with what they wanted me to engage with. So they moved me to second stage, which was thirst and air. So it closed in 2008, but off I went there. And I stayed there just under a year. So you do the groups, and I couldn't, you know, 31 years of using, you don't need many social skills, and you don't definitely do group skills. So I struggled with group, and my defense was to lash out of the group verbally, you know, because I felt scared, I felt inferior. And when I did kind of think of something to say, by the time it got around to me, someone else had overset it. And I thought, boom, you know, I'm going to sound like an idiot now. So 3 months of that, and I just exploded. And they had to ask me to leave. I left for a week. They asked me to do an anger assessment. And I apologized for exploding, and the bloke that was trying to provoke me apologized for trying to provoke me, and they kind of took that into consideration and brought me back a week later. And it was then I realized I had to engage in group, because, you know, I didn't want to die and I didn't want to do a life sentence, and them explosions were kind of horrendous. So I engaged with group, and at the beginning I said, listen, I've got loads of feelings, loads going on, but I can't explain none of it. It's like a washing machine that just keeps on turning over, loads and loads of things, I said. And slowly but surely, I engaged with the group. We had to do NA meetings there. This was in Clapham, the rehab. And so off we went. And because it was an all-male rehab, we went every night just to get out of there and just to socialise with girls, basically. Very self-obsessed. It was all about the clothes you wore. Went to all the meetings where the good-looking girls went, and they must have been trying to avoid us. I mean, they must have moved along just to avoid this posse of men that came from Thurston. It was crazy, but I did establish a network of NA meetings I could do for when I left there. And when it came time to leave, I was still extremely raw. I was advised to leave there with a sponsor. The thought of asking a sponsor and being rejected petrified me, so I couldn't even ask anyone. But I was in a meeting, a Thursday night meeting, and the sponsor coordinator, and I went up to him and said, I need a sponsor, I'm leaving rehab in a few months, blah, blah, blah. And he went to me, I've got the right person for you. And he called this bloke over. He was skinny, he was old, and I thought, I'm going to snap him in half. Mentally and physically, I thought, and I agreed to him to be my sponsor, but he kind of snapped me in half, basically. So we did a little once a week coffee shop, introduced ourselves, did my life story. Then he asked me to do step one from the green and gold. And so back then, I didn't have a laptop or nothing, couldn't even use a laptop. I wrote it all down, and I used to hide it. I was ashamed of it. The thought of someone seeing my inner soul, I'd hide it all over the place. I was living at my mum and dad's then, and I didn't want my mum or dad finding it. And I was just so much shame attached to who I was, or someone getting close to me. I was so used to pushing people away. And when I went to read that to him, I said, you repeat anything I say to you, I will snap, you know, I'll break your kneecaps. Is what I said to him. And he said, listen, mate, when I leave this calf, I don't even think about you, so don't worry about that. You're the last thing in my head. And that really brought me down to size and made me realise, you know, he doesn't... I thought he went around thinking about me all day long, but he kind of made it quite clear he didn't. And he was extremely clever and bright. You know, he had immense IQ, and he could explain everything in detail to me and why I needed to do things and why I needed to get commitments. And so I got a commitment and a detox center, and I didn't want to do that. And he said, I need to do that. I need to help people to get out of myself. And every time I left that detox center, I used to think, oh my God, you know, it's so raw in there. And I used to feel grateful for the few, I must have had about a year clean then. And I was grateful for it. And it kind of reminded me where I'd come from. Yeah, it was a good reminder. So we did step one, two, three, got to four, and we kind of stalled. By now, like, I think I know best. Loads of girls in the equation, and I'm having fun, and, you know, I've got my black key ring, and when I got that black key ring, I felt so like part of the gang now. I've finally arrived, and I thought all work ceased then. So we kind of parted ways, and it wasn't a good idea to part ways. I wish I'd never done that. One of my regrets. Love hate relationship with NA from then onwards. But I did end up working for the man, so yeah, I always had a lot of respect for him. Did loads of meetings at the beginning. I was told to do 1990. I did more than that. I did 2 a day for over a year. Never worked. Suggested to me in a meeting I'd do voluntary work. Off I went to do the voluntary work bit. Volunteered at the drug and alcohol service, And also, when I got clean, I'd lost my British citizenship. So I could volunteer, but I couldn't work. I didn't have a bank account. I did have a driving license and everything, because my dad was born in Seychelles. They were independent. He and my two brothers went and got their British passports, and I left it, and I'd left it too long. So technically, they didn't have to give me one, and because I was a pain in the ass, they said, we're not going to give you one. So that's another hurdle I had to overcome. But I knew if I went back to using, I felt sorry for myself, nothing would change. I just had to wait, and the law changed. And I got it through my mother. When I got clean, you could only get your citizenship through your father. Because he lost his, I lost mine. My mother's obviously British because she's born in Scotland. So eventually I got it through my mother. I got a passport. Knock on effect was I got a bank account. I got a driving license and all that came with it. Anyway, I did the voluntary work. Did everything that was offered to me. Went on to get a job, and I worked in the drug and alcohol field, and ended up being a service manager, worked most of West London, and then because I was giving out advice about Hep C to my clients, and then ended up joining the Hep C Trust, is who I work for now. I did the treatment, cleared the Hep C, another good thing that came out of being clean. When I got clean, it was like someone had ripped, it was like a computer system, and someone had ripped all the wires out, and you go blank. I remember when I was detoxing, you asked me the name of my grandmother, and I couldn't even remember it. I went, it came to me afterwards, but my memory is shut down completely. And then you've got to rewire your brain. I knew all the things not to do, because I've had it rewired so badly for years. So I knew which holes not to rewire it into, but I didn't have a clue where to rewire it correctly. And that has took me years and years to do, and a lot of help from NA to achieve that. If you get your life back and, you get relationships. I'm sensitive, so, I was falling in love, and if you didn't text me back in 5 minutes, I was getting upset. It was just crazy. And you're doing it, but you can't stop it even. That was the crazy part. It's not even a good look. But you kind of feel powerless, and it was just crazy early recovery was. So one of my girlfriends cheated on me. That blew my head apart. That really hurt. I felt really let down. And she went off with someone else, and that really, really, really hurt me and sent me head into a white spin. Obviously, I upped my meetings, spoke to my sponsor a lot, and one of his suggestions back then was to do a gratitude list every morning, and I had to ping it over to him by text form. Eventually, I ran out of things to be grateful for that weren't already mentioned, just repeating myself. And so I was kind of getting bored of that one. Girlfriend, currently, I've been in an 8-year relationship. We went to Cape Town just before lockdown, the first one. And we got caught out there, and she ended up using cocaine out there and carried on using. And she's now in rehab in Ibiza. She's about 3 weeks clean. Doing good. I'm flying out at the end of the month of a holiday, and then we're coming back and seeing where we stand. Relationships has been the hardest one, even the one with myself, and being honest with myself is a real struggle sometimes. To be really, really honest is really, really hard, I find it, around everything. I kind of gauge my recovery, acknowledged. I drive, yeah? I used to do road rage. But the longer I've been in recovery, the more I'd work, you know, steps and everything and do recovery and actually practice it, the less road rage I get. So when that doesn't happen and I'm quite civil on the roads, I know I'm working a good program. Well, it might just be that's old age now. So I'm really polite on the roads and I drive around at a slow pace and I don't go around speeding like I would do. I've got a life now, which I never had. I've got a job, I've got everything I need. My mum trusts me now. She used to hide a handbag when I was using in case I took money out of it, which I had done. I'd take money out with the good intentions of putting it back there once, you know, I'd go and score and the good intention was I'd go and score, get sorted, do a bit of graft and then give her back the money. That never happened. So, my family didn't trust me basically. And now I control all my mum's bank accounts. A lot of my brother's money goes through my bank accounts too. He wouldn't even tell me where he lived when he got a new place when I was using because he didn't want me around there in case I stole something. There's a lot of damage along the way. But dad, I was never able to change the relationship with my dad. But I did know, because his local pub, I used to bump into his mates and they said, we never heard of you, never even mentioned you for years. And all he does is talk about you these days. We didn't even know you existed. And he's so proud of you and what you've done with your life. So that really touched me. But he could never say that to me. It was just, he was old colonial, old school, stiff upper lip. You don't show your feelings. But I knew, cancer eventually got him. He passed away. I was there for him. I was clean. I was in hospital holding his hand when he passed away. My mum was there. My brother was there. We all stood around his bed. So knowing that he went to his grave, not having to worry about me, was a relief. And that's all down to this recovery, you know. I did all the other fellowships, but I've just come back 10 acres. That's where I feel at home. It's like wearing a comfortable pair of slippers. I mean, I looked around this meeting before it started and I thought, you know, it's very seldom I go to a meeting not know anyone in it. And the one person I did know left after 2 seconds. So I thought, oh. So normally I know loads of people, but I still feel comfortable here. It's crazy. It's just like walking, you know, and I've said this in meetings before, I might not like everybody. I might not even get on with everybody, but I need everybody. I do need everybody in the meeting. I need to connect with people and I need to open my mouth. The biggest thing I ever learned from recovery was share and talk about how you feel. And that was a hard one for me coming from a colonial father and stiff upper lip attitude. So now I talk about most things. I don't have to share about it in meetings. I could call a friend, call my sponsor. But it does get talked about, unlike before, where I just keep it inside so it exploded. I even made notes. This was going to be my best cheer ever, but I'm just rambling on. What I'd like to end up is more spiritual. I need to look at that. I've gathered all the materialistic things I wanted and I'm not happy still. And I'm left with myself basically. And I need to look at that more in depth now, which is what I'm aiming to do and get more spiritual and spiritual growth. Being caught up in a rat race is not very spiritual. And I need to change that because I'm not interested no more. And I'm aware I've got like half a minute left and, you know, if you think there's loads of meetings, I've gone to loads of meetings in NA. Some I didn't get nothing out of. Some I've left more angry than I went in. But most of them I've left better, honestly feeling better. There's very few. And, you know, I've done most of the meetings in London. I did this one years ago. I did the cheer, the little baby cheer, as I said earlier. And I thought that was, this used to be a huge meeting. So when Natasha asked me, I was expecting loads of people. I'm glad it's not loads of people, because my ego just kicks in and I need to impress everyone. I hope you got something out of that. And I'm going to leave it there because my alarm's just gone off. And Hugo, well, the secretary, just lifted his finger. So thank you very much for listening. I'm leaving it there. Thank you.